I take this opportunity to share some reflections around the practice of the Dhamma, my understandings, Tanisha and I would constantly like to remind you all that out of our reflections, what you find is useful, that's lovely. And what doesn't seem so useful doesn't seem to apply. We can let that go. I don't presume to know what everybody should do. I have enough trouble deciding what I should do. But it is the case, it is honest, to say that in the 30 or so years of practice that I've had the chance to contemplate the Buddha's teaching, I feel immense good fortune to have encountered a teaching which encourages me to question my assumptions about what I am. To look more deeply into this experience of being human. I now find myself with a lot of energy for practice. Even though I'm not very physically energetic, I oftentimes have a lot of interest in reflecting on this experience. Not only my experience, but then the experience of others that I meet, like yourselves. I'm interested. Energy comes out of that. I suppose what I would like to, there's all sorts of teachings one can give. But what's quite significant, it seems to me, is to find a way, and so that our Dhamma activity, our Dhamma inquiry, is sustainable. It somehow it goes on. It's nice to be inspired. And inspiration has its place. We can go quite a ways on inspiration. Excited, hope, confidence, sense of direction, maybe even a sense of goal. That inspiration perhaps was catalyzed by something we saw in a book, maybe meeting someone, hearing someone that evoked trust. But it's my experience that you can't ride inspiration all the way. Just like you can't breathe in all the time. In-breath's very nice. Fresh. It's inspiring. In-breath is inspiring. But if you only want to breathe in, you've got a problem. There's a time when that reaches its peak, and then there's expiring, which has its blessing too. There's bound to be a disenchantment. The enchanted, some enchantments can be useful. We're enchanted with the path, enchanted with the possibility, enchanted with the potential. That's rooted, I believe, in something true. But we don't really know what it is we're going for. But we have a sense something needs to be done. We have a sense of the dangers of just not doing anything. The dangers of just going along with our habits. What are the dangers of our habits? Our habits sometimes get us to do things that we regret. I remember once when I was young, before I became a monk, I was in my early 20s, and I had gone to France to pick apples during the season, grapes and apples, with my girlfriend, and I was just starting to meditate. I didn't have a teacher, but I knew that there was something I needed to find inside, so I was sort of finding my own way. A little clumsily, but I would do something, close my eyes and rev up. And at that particular time, I think my girlfriend didn't approve that much. Well, there were some tensions between us. Somehow I found myself getting angry at the end of my meditation, angry about something, resenting something with her. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I was on the edge of this canyon. The Gorge du Tarn, Gorges of Tarn. There was this massive stump next to me that had been cut. Big, huge log of wood that had been cut who knows how long ago. And I was just so angry that I saw that and went, just pushed it over the edge. Great sense of doing something with that anger. As I looked over the edge, this horror, as it was bounding down this mountain, there was a road below me, and someone walking on the road. And feebly, feebly in my heart sort of said, come back. As far as I could tell, I missed this person by... But it's that image, and then it bounded down this mountain. Who knows, it seemed like a mile down to this, way, way down. And over the years, this image of we set things in motion, and when we're reckless, not careful, not mindful, not concerned about karma, what we create with our mind, with our thoughts, with our words, with our deeds. So there is danger. There's dangers here. I used to be a prison chaplain. Visit people in prison who were interested in meditation. And you know, we can think murderer. That's just a scary word. That's somebody out there. But in going into prison, I realize these guys are human, just like me, just like you. I visited a young man who was 18, 19. He'd been in already 6 years. He got angry. really angry. And he took a piece of a chair and beat up his good friend and killed his friend. Just in rage. We all can get angry. But how often have we just really contemplated what we can do in a blind fury? What we can do when we're blinded by desire? We sometimes don't consider what's going to be the impact of this. It's useful to be afraid sometimes. Useful. Fear can stop us and at least make us pause. I went to another prison, I remember. These prisoners were considered dangerous, so they weren't allowed to meet together. But because it was the full moon of May, near there, in a special celebration for Buddhists, commemorating the birth, the enlightenment, and the passing of the Buddha, then for the first time, these prisoners who had expressed an interest in meditation were allowed to meet with me, meet together. That was considered dangerous, so they had to let us meet in the room, but they had, you know, it was inside a prison with massive walls and barbed wire and all that, in a remote part of, in barren part of England, in the southwest at a place called Dartmoor. In a little village called Princetown. So we had these guards outside the door that weren't very respectful of my shaved head and my robe. They weren't that knowledgeable about different religious traditions, though, because they thought I was a Hare Krishna. So they spent time kind of mocking, saying, "Hare, Hare, how you doing, Hare?" which created a certain atmosphere. And then we have this group inside. Who aren't used to meeting with each other, not used to meeting with me. And so I thought, well, let's do a kindness meditation. Even before we got started, really, the guy on my right, named Arthur, said, "I don't have any kindness. I'd break his neck again if I had a chance." And I didn't say it out loud, but inside I'm thinking, well, that was a good start. But the way my teachers taught us kindness was not that you have to pretend, now let's all just love those guards. They are very nice beings inside, I'm sure. Come on, smile wider and wider and wider. Can you feel it now? They didn't teach us like that. Thank goodness. Because if you wanted to be a grump, you could be a grump in the monastery. When they taught you kindness, they taught you, can you allow that state? Or do you have to kill it? You have to shift it. Do you have to improve it? Do you have to change it? Our teacher taught us peaceful coexistence, peacefully recognizing that this has its right to be, this moment, meditatively, this mood, this thought, this emotion, this sensation, this circumstance, not as an eternal fixed position, but in moments to be able to practice sensing the perfection of this. Welcome this. So, after I recovered from Arthur's, I'd break his neck again if I had the chance, and I said, well, can you, that conviction that you have no kindness and no compassion, Can you just be with that? Just allow that. You don't have to like these guards out there mocking us. Can we just allow it? Allow our attention to not fight it, not add to it some extra aversion. If we have aversion, then we allow that. We honor that, but we're creating a mind that is peacefully with what's manifesting itself. It's one of these moments of where something special happens, kind of melt down. We melted, and Arthur, in just allowing himself to be hateful, to want to break his neck again, to be convinced that he had no kindness, to be given permission just to allow that, rather than me giving him a lecture on how he should be, blah, 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 blah. He just was with that, and then Arthur starts crying, and then this room starts melting with just the ease of just being there. And we got big, because our home wasn't the cell anymore. Our home wasn't the room anymore. In allowing, not fighting, in allowing, the abiding becomes spacious. And ironically, for those moments, not forever, but for those moments, we were free. And the guards that were making fun of us were trapped inside some sort of view and opinion for those moments. Inspiration takes us so far, but when we encounter the discouragement, the disenchantment, the obstacles, the states that aren't what we expected them to be, what do we do then? It's an opportunity to get to know our motivation. If we're in it just to feel better, improve our reaction time, relax a little. These are not bad motivations, self-fulfillment, something else we can add to our list of skills. Those aren't bad things. But they tend to be sort of positive. And sometimes if we start running into choppy water, the deserts of practice, that excitement, that hope, that expectation, that starts to elude us. And sometimes we find if our motivation is mainly just to make ourselves a bit better, sometimes we find ourselves losing interest in scanning and checking what else is out there, which is, again, is not bad, but we tend not to go very deep. We try a bit of this, we try a bit of that. When our motivation starts to hit another level, we start to be really interested in suffering. Not just interested in feeling good, we're also interested in when we're not feeling good. Not just because we want to get away from that. Something in us recognizes you don't get away from it for that long. Seems to me that at some point one realizes that you've got this shadow that needs to be met, and then our motivation can find a, to me, a deeper level when there's this interest in understanding suffering, being free from this through understanding it, comprehending it, being capable of meeting it. Then it's not just inspiration. Okay, inspiration is nice, but what is it that allows us to stay with when it's not so good? When it's heavy, when it's discouraging, when it's painful, when it's doubtful. And even that, then sometimes we can run out of steam. We can think, oh God, I am interested in suffering, but I need holidays out there. we're exhausted. And it is useful, if we can, to pause, to gather, to collect, to find and consider that which resources us, that which gives us some ease. That's where it's helpful. And we're Tanis and I are very fortunate to have good teachers that can help us negotiate those difficult places. But in those places, sometimes when we feel like we have to understand suffering, then there's this sense of, I can't do it. You know, it's too much for me. It's overwhelming me. It's too much. There's the sense of, I just can't do it. And it can be very useful to also access another level, another dimension of motivation, and that's compassion. How many others are just like me? How many others are afflicted in this world by sickness? How many others in this world right now are afflicted by confusion? Afflicted by desire that blinds us, and we just feel on fire. And we can't think of whether it's right or whether it's wrong. There's this deep sense of, I've got to have. Or conversely, the rage, the irritation. How many others are afflicted just like us? Just like us. And yet we have this good fortune. We might feel like we're being overwhelmed, but we have, all of us, have encountered a great wisdom tradition. Maybe several. But just in terms of this particular contemplation, we've encountered this ancient wisdom tradition of awakening. We've been offered, we have varying degrees of capacity in our skills, but we've all been offered the reflection that yes, there is suffering, and it can be turned to, and that can ennoble us. And by turning to it and having the opportunity to be with this experience of that which is not easy to be with, there's the possibility of recognizing how it's generated, how we're doing the suffering, doing the suffering. That actually no one can make us suffer. This sounds like what? In this sense, no one can make us suffer. People can make us feel pain. People can hurt our body. Maybe people can hurt our feelings. But to make us suffer, what we do with that is something we do. Take the country where Tanisha and I have been living for 12 years, Nelson Mandela, 27 years locked up in a little cell, forced to do labor that ruined his eyes, sent off to a remote island off the coast of Cape Town. If you have a chance to read his autobiography, I think what's it called? Long Walk to Freedom. Read it. He could have easily just got embittered. What they've done to me, blah, 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 blah. I'm sure he met all sorts of difficult, overwhelming, depressing, agonizing circumstances. But something in him recognize and chose, what am I going to do with this? What am I going to create out of this? So he chose, I'm going to turn this cell into a university. And he was then able to inspire, make a difference. His example made a difference to all those with him. Let's learn from this. Grow from this. Not just hate our captors. Even when he got permission to read, he learned the language of his captors and started reading their poetry so he could understand their mind. People who hated him for years, when they'd meet him, so many found themselves changing. One person's life making such a difference. Our life makes a big difference. All of us have an orbit of beings in our life. All of us have people that are affected by how we think profoundly, how we speak, how we act. Each of us has beings, many beings, that are affected by us. It's a whole another dimension of motivation when we consider how I am makes a difference. So when we consider when we're suffering or being overwhelmed, then sometimes when we consider that, if we think, if I can be patient with this despair, if I can be patient with this sense of the barren territory, oh, I don't know if I'm getting anywhere, I know, man, all this practice, and what do I got to show? And you think, well, what if I was to be with this state and dedicate my moments of being with this state somehow, in being able to understand this state a little more, may I somehow share that with others, be able to share it with others. This sense of our link with others. This is what the Buddha called bodhicitta. Bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakened, citta, heart. It's an awakened heart that's sensitive to how awake everyone else's heart is. It's a heart that is not fooled by the conventional boundaries. Oh, this is me, that's you. I'm feeling good. That's your problem. When you start to contemplate that really that sense of separateness is a way of perceiving, but it's not really true. It's not really true. We're so interwoven. We start to sense our kinship with our fellow beings. And we start to realize that there is suffering. It's not just my suffering and your suffering. There is suffering. So the bodhicitta is about being committed to awakening, but being committed to awakening the whole. Just like our body, not just being committed to my face. Only my face is what's important, everything else is not. I mean, my feet are way down there, and my butt, well, it's a bit smelly, and it's covered up anyway, so I don't have to worry about that. Just notice your face. We know what happens if we ignore parts of our body. We totally ignore it. Even a little toe can get incredibly painful. We're affected by the whole. This bodhicitta starts to realize that we're all, we have this kinship. And it was this compassion of the Buddha that allowed us to be here. That's what made the Buddha the Buddha. The Four Noble Truths are the seed of that. There is suffering, and we see how it's caused, and we let go and taste that peace. We cultivate the path that leads to peace. But what led the Buddha to be the Buddha was contemplating, yes, there is suffering, countless beings suffer. I vow to help liberate them all. It's a mind-blowing vow, incredible vow, it's inconceivable vow. And yet just to consider that we here are 2,500 some odd years later still being touched by that intention. He created a teaching that is still rolling, that we can still access. So may each of us consider. Or just consider that what we do makes a difference. That we bring forth some resolve to cultivate the way, not just for our own fulfillment. Yes, also to meet the shadows of our lives so that we can go deeper, not always be escaping from the fearful, so that we can learn little by little to stand our ground and find our home, a deep home at the heart of this moment, find some peace, and to also consider that we share this earth, to consider that we have the potential to make a difference to many other beings. These are really teachings of emptiness. This is what emptiness is really all about. The opposite of emptiness is we imagine that I'm here and you're there. You're this bit and you're that bit. The understanding of emptiness comes out of the understanding of anatta, not self. This can be a really perplexing aspect of the Buddhist teaching. Sometimes people that just hear that just immediately turn off. It can give you a headache, but it will be patient. It's not just something we think through, but it's something that emerges out of our connection with change. When we start to see what we thought of as me, this is me, I'm here, this is happening to me, don't hurt me, you're bothering me, he seems so solid, so real. Then when we start to investigate what we think of as me and what we think of as you, as we've been discussing, we start to notice this very body that seems like me shifting, inhaling, exhaling, painful, pleasant, moment after moment. We start to contemplate that if things are really changing, then where do we find a resting place. Dukkha means that if we ask for something to give us security, that its nature is to keep becoming otherwise. Ajahn Chah, our teacher, would say that's like asking a chicken why it's not a duck. Just, why are you a chicken? You knew I always wanted something that quacked, and you're making all this racket in the morning. Why couldn't you just be a duck? This is stupid, isn't it? And yet, we get upset because conditions don't do what we want them to do. We want praise to always be praise. We want pleasant feeling to stay pleasant feeling. We don't want to be criticized. That's like asking a chicken why it's not a duck. So when we start to see change, we realize that things are suffering if we want them to be what they can be. And so anatta comes out of that. It's not a thing. It's not a self. It's not an entity. It's a process. So that's why in the reading last night we were talking about that when we take these forms, this body, these moods, these sensations as me, and we lean on them, that's birth, and we create death. We create death. What? When we take something and then we assume it's me, and we climb onto it like strength, like praise, like success, that's birth. Because it inevitably, by the law, has to become otherwise. That's the way this cosmos is built. By taking that to be me, we then create death, because it changes. And then we feel shaken. So we say that circumstance is empty of self. The Buddha put it this way. Suppose a man who was not blind beheld the many bubbles on the Ganges as they drove along, and he watched them and carefully examined them. Then after he carefully examined them, they would appear to him empty, unreal, and insubstantial. Bubbles, you know bubbles? You can blow a bubble.
What?
Is that the Hebrew
word?
Buat. The bubble has beautiful colors. Amazing. But they're there and pop, they're gone. In exactly the same way does the monk behold all the corporeal phenomenon, that means the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, states of consciousness, whether they be of the past or the present or the future, far or near. He watches them and examines them carefully, and after carefully examining them, they appear to him empty, void, without a self. A bubble has colors, form, beautiful. And it's gone. If you say it is, the bubble is, I saw it, and then pop. And someone else says, no, it isn't. It's not there. But then you say, well, there it is. There's the bubble again. Pop. So the word it is doesn't really capture it. It isn't. Doesn't really capture it. When the conditions are right, the bubble appears. When the conditions change, pop. And yet language, we so want language. Make up your mind. Is it or isn't it? Is it real? Don't fuff around with me. Is it real? Sorry about that. Is it real? See? There it is. Pop. No, it's not real. And there it is. The middle way. If you go around saying it's real, you don't haven't really met the popping of the bubble. If you go around saying it's unreal, you haven't met the appearance of the bubble. Our thoughts get us in trouble when we don't realize they're a tool, when we won't thoughts to tell us who we are. Come on, who am I? The awareness can notice the bubble appear and it pop. It can hold both. It can hold the process. We want to fit that into a thought. That's asking a chicken why it's not a duck. It's asking thought to do more than it can do. All conditioned dharmas, said the Buddha, are like dreams, illusions, bubbles, shadows, like dewdrops in a lightning flash. Contemplate them thus. All of the conditions are like these bubbles. I haven't been in Israel that much, but do you also get, I think you do, but do you get dew on the grass in the mornings here sometimes? You do. Is it beautiful? In Africa, it can be so beautiful. When the sun hits the dewdrops on the grass, it looks like jewels. When I'm walking with our beloved dog in the morning sometimes, and he goes very slow, he's old now, sometimes I can then see the dewdrops more and see them like diamonds on the plants and things and on the grass. And the heart goes, and goes out to them. But do they have a self? Are they things? Then as the sun comes up, the temperature changes, it's gone. We call it dewdrop, but it's connected to the sun, to the temperature, to everything. We call this me, it feels like me, but we're connected to breath, we're connected to consciousness, we're connected to so many other conditions. So not self, empty, is a way of reminding us not to let go of this idea of this thing. We then allow things to appear and disappear. Wisdom says I'm nothing, a great saint said, Sri Nisargadatta, wisdom. We've been practicing a lot, wisdom, seeing clearly. Because we've been so glued to our body and our feelings and our moods, because we're so close to them, and when we're so close, identified with how we feel, and we feel good and we identify with it, then when it changes, we feel depressed. So we're practicing seeing change, seeing suffering, seeing not self, seeing empty, letting it go. So wisdom says, I'm not a thing. And in letting go, we're discovering the peacefulness of not clinging, the spaciousness, that depth below the waves, the silence around the sounds that we can rest in. But if we take a stance against conditions, not always just to stay in that emptiness, that spaciousness, we can still have a split, can still be quite averse. And it's really useful to remember to welcome form, that actually form is not different from emptiness. Emptiness is not different from form. The words of the famous Heart Sutra, the teaching of the Buddha. Wisdom says I'm nothing. Compassion says I'm everything. Wisdom lets go. But if we attach to this idea of just not being in contact, then we need to balance that by welcoming form again. This great saint, Srinivasagadatta, said this phrase, wisdom says I'm nothing, compassion says I'm everything, between these two banks, the river of the wise one flows, the river of the saint flows. Practicing letting go, practicing peace, sensing our spaciousness, sensing that ultimately no word, no condition can define what we are. But then remembering that everything arises within this one heart, and that we can remember our kinship with each other and with all forms by then welcoming kindly. In these discouraged, dry places in our practice, when we've lost our inspiration, then it's very important to have a kind heart, compassionate heart that's willing to embrace and just be with, hang out with these difficult places. Over the course of the 30 years, I've been through some dark places, discouraged places. And to me, the willingness just to begin again, to be patient, to be kind, to practice letting go and sensing the spaciousness, to practice welcoming and deepening our capacity to be with conditions. Don't be afraid of this emptiness. It's not a dead emptiness. The spaciousness of our heart allows us to feel what's present. When we're so full, when we think that the reality of our being has to be an opinion, it has to be who I am, it has to be something, then we can be so full that we don't meet life. Our teacher said that it's good to let yourself be empty. Not an emptiness that excludes things, but an emptiness that's available. He said, be like a bell. Even though it might look like it's just sitting there. He said, be like a bell. And a bell, when a bell is empty, when the bell is empty, it's useful. Because if something touches it, it can resonate. But if we think, oh, gee, that's a lot of wasted space. I mean, come on, this is the 21st century. It's a dangerous world out there. We've got to lock things up, we've got to have keys, and you've got to remember time, because if you don't remember the time, you'll kind of forget. where you are. Doing waste. I mean, that's just a lot of wasted space. And now I'm not wasting anything. We're like that. We just so. Our minds got to remember what to say, remember what to do, remember this, remember that, all these kind of things. And emptiness means I'm not a thing, but it's not, we're not taking a stance against things. We're letting things be there and then letting things dissolve. Then when there's heaviness, we can resonate with pain, and that's called compassion. The English word is beautiful. Passion means to suffer, come suffer with. Because we're empty enough to feel the pain. When there's beauty, we're empty enough to resonate with the beauty. Whatever there is, if we're empty enough, we're empty enough to be with it. So let's not just prefer inspiration. Inspiration is nice, but when you get down, can we be empty enough and honor, can we honor that so we can really get to know it, really let it run its course. So it is said that emptiness is not empty. When emptiness is empty, that means we're averse to everything. That's dead. Existence doesn't exist. When existence is really real, then we're clinging to it, and then when it changes, we feel let down. If we think existence exists, the body is, then it's like that bubble. It's real, and then pop. It's not real. The ones that are saying not real are saying emptiness. The ones that see the bubble and say, it's real, that's like, there really is something. The Buddha said, you're wasting your time saying there is, there isn't, there is, there isn't. Our emptiness allows form to come, it allows form to go. One of the masters that's inspired Tenzin and myself so much, there's Lumpa Cha, which we've talked about a lot, and also the Chinese master, Master Hua, who I sort of, because I didn't know what to say, I said, do you like it here? And you know, he said, yeah, I like it everywhere. He also said something which Tanisha and I readily remember, that relates to this theme of don't be afraid of letting yourself get empty. And remember, it's not an emptiness that denies stuff. It's an emptiness that allows things to come and go. The master said, and this is a reminder of what I believe we're all growing into. Maybe it's not growing into, we're all relaxing into. The master said, all living beings are my family. The universe is my body. Empty space is my university. My name is empty and formless. Kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity are my function. All living beings are my family. each of us is arising in our heart right now. The universe is my body. Empty space, that's where I learn, wherever I am. Empty space is my university, my name, my true nature is empty and formless. Kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity are my function. Whether it's inspiring or depressing, may we find the faith to just keep staying with how things are, trusting that as we let them come and go, we can resonate in a way that is a blessing for this world, for our families, for our ancestors, for our community, for our country, for our world.